You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
Together with Gina McDonald, we will find out how she became the star power behind the creation of spaces for people to explore their relationships with themselves and their world. So please welcome Charlotte Church.
Hello.
Charlotte, welcome to Greenbelt.
Thank you so much. It's lovely to be here.
I'm really delighted to be having this conversation with you because it's not talking about Christian nationalism, which I have normally been on this stage talking about, but also just digging into some of the amazing things that you are involved in. I think that Greenbelt audience will really love who you are and what you do. You've had one of the most extraordinary public lives of anyone in Britain, really. You started as The Voice, child star singer at the age of 11, 12, and your career has really taken a really interesting direction, particularly in recent years. You've been a pop star, you've been a presenter, you kind of explored spirituality, connection with the earth. We build you at Greenbelt as a musician and community builder, but how would you describe yourself today?
I think you know, a singer is my core, and then I am a real novelty seeker. I think I'm pretty neurodivergent, and so after about 5 years of doing something, I'm like, I have to change and go for a deep dive into something else. So I think that I would really say singer. That's my core. Yeah.
And you, in recent years, you've set up new organisations, retreats. Tell us about some of that kind of spiritual work that you're doing, this kind of spiritual, ecological, some of the stuff that you're doing. What are you up to?
Absolutely. So I feel very passionate about Mother Nature. I feel very passionate about humans and the more than human world and how exquisite the beauty and complexity of the abundance of nature all around us, and doing our best to be good custodians. And I feel the sharp edge of the knife of that not happening in the world. And so I feel really passionate about how do we reconnect human beings to their own souls, to the great web of life, to each other. So I've done that in the past through the Awen Project, which was a free-to-attend democratic learning community in the forest that I set up with my husband about 8 years ago. And then about 5 years ago, set up The Dreaming, which is in just outside of Rhaeadr, in the heart of Wales, in this beautiful place, two waterfalls, the Nant Gorwen and the Nant Caethon, amazing forests, and yeah, just the elders, the elder trees on that landscape, and all of the beings that live there have just, yeah, really taught me a lot. So yeah, my life has gone in very interesting ways, and I've just sort of followed the path.
Well, we might come back to, I want to touch on a bit of climate anxiety, maybe, and thinking about the future, a bit of eschatology, but that will come. Mm-hmm. You have been in the spotlight since you were 11, 12. You did some amazing, unthinkable things, I can imagine, for an 11, 12-year-old at that time. Tell us what life was like for you. Was it joyful or was it pressure-filled?
So when I was a kid, when I was really young, so more like, you know, 12, 13, a lot of it at the beginning was extraordinarily exciting, you know, plucked from obscurity, and yeah, just put on the world stage, traveling, meeting, you know, world famous people. It was so exciting and exhausting. Like, it was a lot of work as well. And for the first year, I just travelled with my mum. And so that was quite a lot of pressure on us. But then as soon as my dad started travelling with us, then it was a bit better. Because he's more traditionally maternal than my mum is. So when it was just me and my mum, I'd be ironing all of my own stage costumes and such. And then when my dad came on board, then he sort of looked after us both whilst we were travelling around. But it did turn quite quickly. And I think the glamour and the excitement became, you know, particularly then into my teenage years, when it's like the business side of it gets really intense when you're successful and then you're a commodity and then there's a value to you. Then I think that in lots of levels, in lots of ways, whether it's like the record company that I was working with, whether it's the press, then people dehumanize you, you know? And so, yeah, it got much more difficult into my teenage years. And also, I was a teenager, you know, and being a teenager is difficult. You're, you know, fuming and like full of all like insane changes, really trying to figure out who you are and what's happening and what you want, like really rejecting your parents often as well. And so, yeah, it was a bit of a pressure cooker. For me and my mum and dad whilst we were on the road. Because it was also like a lot of travelling and working.
And I can imagine there was a lot of excitement, singing for presidents like you did, and being a name that people around the world knew. What was your relationship with the media in those, particularly those earlier years? And how would you characterise how the media landscape maybe has changed since you were young?
So, yeah, it did continue to have, you know, I was incredibly privileged, don't get me wrong, to have so many beautiful experiences of singing with orchestras around the world, getting to see, you know, Rio de Janeiro and Sydney and some of the, you know, the natural places of beauty, Niagara Falls in wintertime. And so there were always moments where it was like amazing and we understood. And also my dad used to say to me, things like this don't happen to people like us. You know, I am like generations common folk, peasant folk. And so he was just like, we just have to take this opportunity whilst we can, because I think he understood that this was a very rare thing. And then in terms of the media, you know, at the beginning, I was the voice of an angel. It's very archetypal, actually. My life could almost be told like an archetypal myth. The media tend to sort of do that as well and sort of shape those. It's sort of interesting when I look back at it with a more mythic, spiritual lens in a way. How, you know, I was this, the angel, and then the sort of fall from grace, and my mother being the evil stepmother, and it gets quite deep. I actually read a woman's PhD. She did a PhD on my life as myth. I was like, wow, that's so cool. as part of my next musical project, I've asked my lovely husband to write my life as a myth. Because as I've gotten older, it's really struck me these sort of archetypal passages, which I think happen to us all. Like it's part of the human journey. Even though we're all, you know, very different and diverse and have our own life path, the life journey, you know, there's quite a shape to it, which we sort of all inhabit, I think.
But then most of us aren't doing it on the world stage. So for you, when you're thinking about the archetypes that you were almost meant to conform to, was there a part of you that played up to the myth, or did you want to rebel against the myth or the archetype?
I was fuming. I was that the injustice of the press, the injustice of being mischaracterized is, it's a stinger. And so I spent a lot of, and particularly also because I was, you know, an adolescent, and also, you know, I come from a line of like fiery, dragon-like women. And so, no, I was annoyed. I was angry and I wanted to fight it. It felt, yeah, the injustice of it. And I kept that and it's protected me a lot. I'm really grateful for that fire because my life could have gone very differently. It's really kept, my sort of, my loyal soldier strong. Which, you know, as I've gotten older and we sort of go on the healing journey and we look at our childhood and we understand what our patterns are and what our wounds are and what is gold, what is gifts, what is shadow. And it's been a very, I feel like I've lived a couple of lives already.
And it feels like that from where I'm sitting as well, because I think you... So we're kind of nearly the same age. I'm a couple of years older, but I feel like you've always been pretty much there since I was a child. And I thought I knew who you were until I had to, you know, prepare for this interview and thought, wow, Charlotte Church is a very interesting, multi-dimensional person. But I also think that watching you on Celebrity Traitors last year, you came across as completely different to what I thought you were. Very chill. Calm, Mother Earth kind of person. Is that what you understand? When you said that you've lived two lives, do you feel like there is the kind of, almost like the wilder, younger phase and the kind of more calm, older years? Or
I think I've been the same throughout. I really feel like the core of me, I imagine everybody sort of feels this way. Of course, we morph and change. Change is the only constant. I love Octavia Butler's this idea that change is God. I feel like, of course, I've morphed and changed, but the center, the core of me is exactly the same all the way through. So, and you know, often... There aren't really eureka moments. You know, often things are a slow burn or a slow grind or lessons take a while to really integrate. I feel like the journey has been a journey rather than sort of handbrake turns, or that's how it might look from the outside, but from living it, it's just like, well, yeah, I set up this democratic school because I had young children and then they were, and I was looking at the education system and thinking, I'm not sure about this and this and this and this doesn't make sense, and doing a lot of research. I think that's the thing that people maybe don't know about me, is that like I am a really curious cat, and then when I get into something I go really deeply into it and get pretty obsessive. And I really like alchemizing. I really like sort of synthesizing different thoughts and ways of being and cultural approaches. So I think for the last 10 years, I've been really digging into all sorts of indigenous cultures throughout the world, particularly the Kogi in Sierra Nevada, the Dagara of Burkina Faso, lots of different Aboriginal cultures in so-called Australia. And I just feel that there's so much to be learned from these real human cultures before modernity comes and does as modernity is done. And I think that is sort of my path now, is what it feels like, that and music. And probably who knows what else.
So, okay, well, what started you on that path towards looking at Indigenous cultures in places that a lot of people have never heard of? What was the start of that?
The start of it was my children get into school age And me taking them, us going around local primary schools and stuff, and me just feeling like intuitively, this is not right. Like, there was just something that didn't feel right to me about, you know, having this really intense and beautiful relationship with our young, and then you sort of give them over to people you don't know for the vast majority of their awake hours every week. It just felt odd. And so I was like, but I'd never thought about it before. I'd never considered that. So I think I'm a very sort of feeling sort of person. I really trust my senses and my intuition. And and so it was through learning about education. So first in a more sort of like structured academic way, the history of education, the science, the neurology, the different types of learning. I went all over the country for 18 months. I went to Eton. I went to social, emotional, mental health schools in some really difficult areas. I went to really creative primary schools in Sheffield, and I went all over the place and spoke to, people who were specialists in education, in curriculum, and then it was through that process that I found a book called Free to Learn by Peter Gray, which was, he's an evolutionary anthropologist. And then it was all about looking at the commonalities within First Peoples or original peoples, indigenous peoples around the world, and their pedagogical approaches, how they teach, how they raise their young. And it just really made sense to me. I was just like, I really get this. and so that then really spurred me on to learn a lot more about culture in those places and their myths, their stories, their relationship to music, their relationship to ritual, their relationship to the earth and spirituality, which of course is different in, I'm not, you know, they're not a monolith. It ignites something in me that feels like a deep balm, like a deep existential balm. And so that's how it started, through the babies.
I love that. So deep existential balm. So we are a Christian festival, Arts, Faith and Justice Festival. So we're really interested in these ideas of spirituality, church, adjacent to church, etc. So for a lot of your career, you have sung a lot of church music. Mm-hmm. What's your relationship to Christianity and then more widely to kind of spirituality?
Well, I would consider myself an animist, and not that I think that labels are that useful necessarily, but or at least we're so deep into labeling everything nowadays that it's becoming more of an issue and more of a separation. But I think that I have always had a deeply spiritual part of me. I think that I was very blessed to be able to enter music in the way that I did through holy music, through Celtic music, and really singing so much music that is so meaningful to people, that is so often the orchestrations and such were, you know, just really beautiful, beautiful, and creating that beauty. I was raised a Catholic. My nan was an Irish Catholic. She wasn't actually Irish, and by the time we get down to the lineage where the only sort of the only ancestral stuff of our Irish past that's passed down is the fact that she doesn't buy any other butter apart from Kerrygold. She makes Irish stew, and we're Irish Catholics. But that's about it. That's sort of all that's left of the remnants of when, in my nan's lineage, they would have come over for in the potato famine. So I grew up going to church every Sunday, And I did my first Holy Communion. And then, yeah, as I grew, I think that the, yeah, Christianity made less sense to me. And the more that I understood about animistic cultures, goddess worshipping cultures, then that made more sense to me. But, you know, I am very much about diversity of peoples and opinions. And, you know, when we look at, there's a beautiful branch of science, I suppose, called biomimicry. And biomimicry is the idea that we are, how can we build our human systems around what nature does, in terms of nature has had billions of years of evolution to perfect systems, to make them really ergonomic and graceful and efficient. And so the way that I think about diversity is in terms of resilience. So often it's at the edge of two different ecosystems. So it might be a forest and a meadow where there's so much diversity in those places that it makes that ecosystem incredibly resilient. And so I really believe in diversity of thought and speech and culture. And I see it as a beautiful patchwork which makes us stronger. And I wish people knew that. I wish people, it's so sad that people don't get that. It makes me feel sad.
So where does that thinking show up in your work? So the dreaming and the retreats that you run, how are you weaving that into your work?
So I think that, you know, so much in our culture nowadays is pushing us more and more towards individuation, or no, not individuation, but, you know, only being concerned with ourselves. It's polarizing us, it's keeping us in silos, in identity politics. And so I'm really interested in, like, messing up the hierarchical structures that keep us separate from one another. And so in the dreaming, we have a pay what you can program. So there's at least one person, often more, on every retreat where if they can afford a fiver a night, that's what it is. We've got a sliding price scale. So our cheapest room for a 3-night experience with everything included is £450, which is as cheap as we can make it. We have a beautiful retreat in the past called A Call to Dream, which was for melanated women of African and Caribbean descent. We have a retreat for Muslim women that the Three Hijabis run. We have a queer retreat. And we're constantly thinking about how are we just making sure that we're not a monoculture of people. How and often, because so much in culture and so much in many of our spaces, it's so curated for white people. That means that we have to go out into communities and we have to put time and attention and money into cultivating relationships so that people trust us and they start to see us as a place where they're safe and they're wanted. Because this land that the dreaming is on is so magical. It's so healing. It's wild. There are many, many holy hills in the world, but this is definitely one of them. It does something really magical to people. It's quite amazing.
And so within the retreats, are there kind of forms of spiritual practice, rituals? What kinds of things do people do?
Absolutely. So our three pillars are sound in all of its forms, ritual, and nature. And so really the way that I see it is that we are drawing people's attention and bodies outside all the time, as much as we possibly can, whether it's at sunrise and then we are listening to an amazing banging playlist and dancing up the dawn, whether it's More sort of like traditional sound healing practices, whether we're doing some collaborative vocal improvisation, which I'll be doing a workshop here later. It's one of my favorite things in the world to do. I found it a couple of years ago and it's so exciting. And so we're just drawing people's attention out to the outrageous show that is happening in nature every day. And just sort of curating these little vignettes of experience. So it might be stargazing and storytelling, or it might be just sitting around the fire with marshmallows and hot chocolates and singing together. And so a lot of it is like, it's simple. It's not clever wellness, let's pump you full of vitamins and massage you and you can be passive. It's deeply, deeply embodied work, connecting back into the web of life. And then through ritual as well, a lot of the ritual that we do is co-created, because in these lands, a lot of our ritual has been stripped away and through successive colonizations. And so, unfortunately, we have lost a lot of that deep ritual practice that would have happened in Wales, in Cymru, and in other lands in the UK. And so in Aboriginal cultures in Australia, they have this phrase called collective sense making, which is the idea that we cause ourselves so much suffering as individuals who are trying to do it all themselves, have all of the knowledge, feel, you know, just that they have to reach this certain peak, whereas actually that's impossible. It's always been impossible, and it has to be held, the knowledge, the culture, it has to be held by the collective. And so in collective sense making, it's really going, you know, all of our fleshy prisms of experience are valid and unique, and Earth Song is coming through us and singing through us in, and then sort of being shined in that prism of light out into the world. And we need everybody. We need everybody's voice. So we co-create a lot of our rituals, and that might be around the moon, the seasons. It could be around, you know, something really symbolic that has happened, maybe with a red kite or one of the beings of the land. People dream for each other a lot when they come on to retreat, and there's all sorts of messages from the dream realm that we might work with. So it's just like it's a buffet.
Sounds very green belt. One thing I was really interested when you said it was the babies that changed you.
Yes.
So I'm going to dig into the motherhood. Mm. And I'm really interested in motherhood and ritual. So the organisation I lead, Theos, we've done some research and thinking around the churching of women, which was a ritual in the Book of Common Prayer that's been kind of eased out over the past few decades for good reasons, like the fact that they talked about women being impure after having children up to 40 days. Anyway, I think that, as you say, we have lost a lot of ritual in a kind of increasingly secular society. For you, when you became a mother, did you have a sense of, was there a ritual or something that was able to communicate the vastness or the kind of change in spiritual ideas that you might have had at that point?
I was very lucky. I was very young having my first Miss Ruby. I was 21. And so that was really good. My body was like in really good shape to have a little one, a baba. And so I was encouraged to have a home birth. And I had an amazing midwife who was my midwife for all of the babies that I've had. And I got to have Ruby at home. I've had all of my children I've had as home births. And so I feel very fortunate to have had that experience. I know in the vast majority that is not a lot of women's experience. And however they come, they come. However they come safely, they come safely. So this isn't about any sort of birthing superiority at all. But I do feel like... I had these beautiful experiences of birth, and they, and I just think, you know, your children are your greatest teachers. They've taught me so much. It's so hard. Parenthood's so hard. And so amazing and so important. And yeah, so I feel like I was lucky enough to have a good start with all of them. Having them young, I felt ready. I did feel ready. And whilst there were definitely enormous mistakes, you know, that I made because I was that young, there was also, you know, shadows and gifts. Everything is shadows and gifts. And the gift side of it was that I had loads of energy. We did loads of stuff. So I think that it's... and I've got such an amazing relationship with them all now. I've got... So, yeah, 19, 17 and 6. And I've also lost a baby that I gave birth to at 17 weeks. And to witness the bookends... of life and death, or birth and death in one, was also an extraordinary privilege. And she, Billy, was possibly our greatest teacher, even though it was a very short amount of time that she was sort of with us. Then, yeah, her existence continues to reverberate throughout our lives.
Thank you. Well, what about the climate? So thinking about the Earth and the future of humankind, the future of the planet, I'm interested in what, how your motherhood informs how you feel about the future of the world.
Yeah.
Not just in terms of... So Hannah Arendt, the philosopher, talks about natality. Mm. As the miracle that saves the world. Hannah Arendt didn't have children herself, but she said this idea of being able to give birth or create new things or put new things forth into the world was an act of hope in a world of despair. And she was writing kind of during the Second World War. How does your motherhood shape your understanding and your feelings about the future of the planet?
What a great question. I've not heard that Hannah Arendt quote either. Thank you. Well. I've got some pretty strong thoughts about the future and where we're headed. And that is partly through my own pattern prediction and my own sensing self, understanding what's happening. And also through my study of Indigenous cultures and their stories and what pretty much a huge amount of Indigenous people around the world are saying about this very time. In terms of my motherhood, and how it shapes how I think about it, it makes me really serious about it. It makes me really warrior-like about it, because I want to create safety for my young, and I want them to live a life that can be as... like, that I do absolutely everything in my... in my power to give them as much protection and as much preparation as possible. And so I think that in part their education and having a very progressive and alternative education is part of that. Partly it's about the Urdaldog, which is where the dreaming is, and, you know, really building systems of self-sufficiency in food, in water, in energy. So, yeah, I think that my babies, like, give me the courage and the power and the strength to look it dead in the eye, because I think that it's so enormous, this collapse that we are witnessing, living through. You know, everything in modernity from the elites is trying to get us to not pay attention, to look away, to be passive. But it's happening. It's happening much faster than we think. You know, there's this sort of, this way of that people think about it, which is like, oh, 2015, something like that, something's going to happen. But it's happening, you know, when we're thinking about, I'm really thinking about, okay, what sorts of things can we do to sound the alarm, not so that there's panic, but it's like we could all be doing so much now that will massively help when the food shortages come, potentially in this year, when the water shortages come, which isn't necessarily stockpiling. You know, it's like, where are the seeds coming from? How are we looking after the seeds? There's a beautiful indigenous writer called Martin Pretschel, who is a New Mexico indigenous man, but he trained in the Mayan tradition, in the Guatemalan Mayan tradition. And it's all about keeping the seeds alive. It's all about how, you know, real human cultures can grow again in the embers of what is dying and what is collapsing. So I take it really seriously, and it's really uncomfortable for a lot of people. My friends are like, shut up. Will you stop talking about the end of the world? But again, when you look at indigenous peoples, you know, the horrors of colonization that they faced, that's an apocalypse. You know, when they had their language, their children taken from them, forced to leave their lands, that is the end of a world. And so I think that, again, they are the people that I am looking to, the people who have already weathered what an apocalypse end of world situation looks and feels like, and actually how it is that birthing of the new generation, looking after the babies, looking after our elderly. That is becomes an act of resistance, you know, having babies, looking after your babies well, becomes the act of resistance in the face of total devastation.
Well, Christian theologians have thought a lot about the end of the world over the centuries, eschatological ideas. So tell us about your end times pop dungeon.
So my end times pop dungeon, basically it used to be called Charlotte Church's Late Night Pop Dungeon, and we curate it. So it's a 9-piece band, and we curate it. We've sort of done festivals over the last 10 years. We haven't done it for the last 3 years, but things were getting so bad, it was just like, we need Pop Dungeon back. And I suppose it's a little bit of a Trojan horse, because it's incredibly fun. We mash up, you know, all sorts of crazy songs. You know, it might be Black Sabbath with Dolly Parton with, Rage Against the Machine and Radiohead and a Disney tune. And so it's just like this real collage. But nowadays, now that it's become end times, and so we've got 4 shows, by the way, in September, in Bristol, Cardiff, Liverpool, and London. And so come and see us. It's loads of fun. But it's got a real message to it now. Before, it was just like total irreverent, take the glass ceiling off of your joy and your love and your feeling and dance and sing, and it was visceral. But now it's like, it's got this really deep message, I think, which is, we open with, I think his name's Skeeter Davis, End of the World. Why does the sun go on shining? Don't they know it's the end of the world? So it starts there, then it goes into Black Sabbath's War Pigs. And we do Children of the Revolution, T-Rex, and Army of Me, Bjork. And so it starts in this really like, warrior-like way. But, you know, we take people through a really emotional journey where actually, we take them really through a process of feeling really connected, really connected to the earth, really connected to each other, really connected to their heart, to their emotions. And then we absolutely break them at the end. But I won't tell you what that is, and just in case you decide to come.
Well, before I move to questions from you, I'm sure you have lots. You are being pulled in lots of different directions, and I sense that you feel a sense of responsibility to speak out on issues you've spoken about, on Palestine, on LGBTQ stuff, on race, climate. How do you find rhythms of rest in your life and kind of slowing down?
I have been really bad at that. And I'm quite a boundaryless person. I think that, you know, I'm very porous, and I really care. I really love people, and I really want to be part of how we heal things, and I think it's possible. But it has, like, this year I have really struggled with burnout, and I mean, it's so silly running a retreat center and just being like, oh my god. So I am currently really looking at the balance of my life and making it more easeful and restful. And for me, I think all I really want to do is grow things. I think that is the answer for all of us. I think for the mental health crisis that's going on, for the lack of community, for the lack of, you know, for physical health as well as mental health, I just think that building soil culture and growing great food and looking after animals really well is the answer. And I know that's not like easeful work, but if you're a farmer doing it, it's really, really hard. You know, if you're only a few people working the land, it's backbreaking work. But if you're a big community, if you're a village, then it becomes much more easeful. And so, yeah, I think that's where my life is leading me now. It's like, for me, it's all about music. It's all about the land. It's all about the babies. And I am starting, as I get older, I turn 40 this year. And as I get older, I'm like, oof, my energy really is finite, isn't it? I felt pretty indestructible in the past. But I'm starting to feel it now. You know, the body starts to go, oh, what's that? Oh, my foot's a bit bad. Yeah. Oh, my hip's a bit funny today. So, but all of that is, you know, this is part of the journey, isn't it? It's humbling. And yeah, but definitely learning how to slow down. But, I'm only just starting to really come to terms over the last couple of years that I'm probably ADHD, somewhere on the autistic spectrum and somewhere on the ADHD spectrum. And so, yeah, that's sort of like my brain works. I'm just learning more about myself. And actually, it is part of what these snakes are about, actually. I saw them in a meditation. They're aquatic coral snakes. They're water snakes. And it was all about being able to wind really tight, but also to then totally unwind and relax and being able to go between those states. That is the definition of wellness, really. Your ability to be able to go from a sort of activated, cortisol, stimulated place to the place of rest through the nervous system. You know, how easy we can flip between those states is your sort of sense of wellness and balance.
Good luck.
Thanks.
Thank you. So, questions.
Hello.
Hi.
I've often watched you presenting songs of praise and also the choral competitions. And I just wonder, in the light of your reply to Hine about Christianity, do you not find some conflict when presenting a very specifically Christian program?
Thank you. That was very, very deep. And lovely to hear about your interest in indigenous wisdom. One of the oldest living cultures of the world is India. And India is not one culture, but many cultures. And the fact that it's a living culture means that it actually has the kinds of rituals, the kind of compassion for all life that you are aspiring for. So in your research, how do you deal with living cultures which embrace some of the kinds of values that we are actually aspiring towards, but have a 3,000, 4,000 year thread that goes deep into that and is very rarely spoken about in these kinds of audiences? You know, thank you.
So I love the breadth of these questions. Very green belt. So we've got indigenous living cultures and ritual and songs of praise over here.
And actually, weirdly, I think I can sort of answer them both in the same breath. And I think it's about the syncretic nature of gods. And there's room for all of our beliefs, and they all bring something different and beautiful and say something different about the not necessarily just the human condition, but the condition of life. And so I really enjoy, so the syncretic is like this idea. I think we often think about purity and again, it's sort of like siloing things of, well, mine is this and yours is this. Whereas actually, like it is in the in Earth Song or God or in the Vedic traditions, you know, it is life speaking through us, and everything has its story and its beauty and its place. And so I find I find that syncretic nature of, you know, you find the Black Madonna in so many different traditions. You might find it in Christian traditions in places. You might find it in voodoo traditions in other places. It's like everything is touched by everything else because of the way that life is on Earth. And so I think that we're all just totally interdependent and interrelated, as are all of the traditions. Like, there will be elements of, Indian traditions, which are, it's echoed in the Mabinogi and in Welsh language understandings. There's so much crossover in cultures. As soon as you really start to look, then it's like, and then it becomes a delicious feast. You know, there isn't a sense of scarcity or what's right. There's just a sense of this, like, it's so deep and it's so complex and it's so beautiful. And the ways in which the things have carried across places and across peoples, and the crossover that's happened, the stories that are attributed to that, I find really delightful. So, yeah, it doesn't feel like conflict in my body. It feels like it's all worship. It's all divinity.
At the end of the last session, Robin Ince shared a story with us about you singing Summertime. And I just wondered, as we were at the end of summer and nearly the end of Greenbelt, whether you'd give us a lovely Greenbelt rendition.
I'll give you a little blast. I haven't warmed up, and I did a gig very late last night and have come from Cumbria. but I'll give you a little go. But it might be a bit low. So. Time and the living is easy. Fish are jumping and the cotton is high. Oh, we are dead. Your mama's good looking, so hush, little baby, don't you cry.
Don't know if anyone's ever told you, but you've got a really good voice.
Hi, thank you, Charlotte. That was amazing. You mentioned that when you set up your school, you did an awful lot of research into education and the history of education, and that made me wonder, if you had the power to change one thing about the national curriculum or just the way we do schooling in this country, what would that be?
It would be stripping out adult supremacy. So the way in which we work, the way in which we are, you know, through generations and generations and hundreds of thousands of years of conditioning, is that our children are ours, their possessions, they're empty vessels that we sort of fill. And I believe that each human being comes here with their own spirit and soul and character and journey, and they are each, you know, filled with a little spark of the divine, and it is our job in which to nurture out. And so I think that if that focus shifted to you have everything inside you already that you need, and we just need to bring that out, rather than you don't know anything and we need to teach you all of this human stuff. There's a homogeny to it, which doesn't make sense to me, and I think that it really fractures the human spirit to make everybody do the same stuff, which lots of people are bad at, different parts of that. And, you know, that starts to sort of build in this, you know, I'm not good enough. So that's the one thing I would strip out, is this sense that we know better.
Part of me is like, don't let my kids hear this. Don't let my kids hear that.
Oh, trust me, like having this experience with my own children, I'm like, girl, I've made a rod for my own back here, haven't I? Crikey.
My question was, if you went back to you as a 12-year-old, if someone told you, A, that you'd still be in the spotlight now, and B, that you'd have done so much, would you believe it?
I wasn't thinking that much at 12. It was just cracking on. Yeah, we're going it great. Would I have believed it? I mean, I've always had a bob on myself, don't get me wrong. Do you know what I mean? That sense of like belief, and I think I'm absolutely fantastic, and I always have. And so I probably would have, and then the ego developed as well, so but I think I would be very surprised at the the different areas of which that I've sort of gone into. At that point I really thought that I was going to be an opera singer, you know, that was going to be my life, that was going to be my path. So I'd probably be a bit surprised at how all over the shop it's been, where I've gone.
Hi, I was thinking about what you were saying about the co-creating aspect of what you do. And I was wondering, there's a lot of discussion, you know, online and in the world at the moment about the difference between cultural appreciation and a cultural appropriation. Mm-hmm. How do you toe that fine and sometimes wobbly line of appreciating without, you know, appropriating?
Yeah, absolutely. Really important question. For me, I follow what Indigenous people tell me to do around it. you know, which is that you're always giving power back to the source of your information. So, you know, I will often talk about specific teachers or, you know, so you're just making sure that you're always giving thanks and power back to where you've learnt whatever amazing information you've learnt. And then it's about applying it to your own land, place, culture. And so my deepening now into the lands that I'm on. So yes, we don't have much left of a lot of, you know, druidic cultures in Wales, but there's so much in the language, for example. And so definitely the next part of my journey is learning the Welsh language, the Mabinogion, deepening into the stories, deepening into my ancestral understanding. I've got an Irish lineage. I know that I've got family that were in the Black Forest in Germany. So like really deepening into my ancestral roots. But it's been through learning, through the depths and the unbroken lineage of people like who have managed to keep their cultures alive through successive colonizations, that I have discovered that depth, and I'm eternally grateful. And then I think it's quite simple. It's just like, you know, don't wear the clothes of, or, you know, it's quite simple, really, the difference between appropriation and appreciation, I think. And you can feel it in your body. So that's how it is for me. And then I think that process of co-creation with the people whom you're with is also a really good way to do that. So it's like, one of my teachers, the way in which they would call in the directions at the beginning of a ritual, they have been taught by Lakota people, and so they would call in the eight directions. But that's not like, I love that. That's really amazing. But I haven't been taught in that tradition. I have witnessed her doing it. But in what I know, and in the tradition that I can feel coming up, and that we have sort of, and also the way that we would do it within a ritual, within the dreaming, is that we would also open the circle. So anybody else can call in anything else, any genius loci, any local gods or goddesses from their own traditions, their own ancestry, maybe people that they've lost. So I think that when you're always leaving it open for the collective, to always be bringing their voice, their creativity, then that is also an important part of not being appropriative.
Thank you, Charlotte. Thank you so much. Thank you for being here at Greenbelt. Thank you for sharing your story and your mind and your voice with us. Please show your appreciation for Charlotte Church.
Thank you. Thank you, Ginny.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.